It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore hospice as a booming industry and the impact on end-of-life care. Call in about your loved one's hospice experience, what you've learned, 800-642-1234. Ava Kaufman is a reporter on ProPublica's national desk. She led an investigation into the hospice industry that was co-published by ProPublica and The New Yorker. Ava, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services found inappropriate billing by hospice providers to the tune of, hundreds of millions of dollars, and that you say that it could be much higher. Why is hospice so lucrative?
Hospice is so lucrative because providers right now get paid every day, regardless of the number of services they provide. So the per diem payment for providers who might be inclined to cut corners allows for what is essentially a kind of money stream. And for providers who are doing it right, I should add, the per diem payment is often not enough because they're stretching their resources to give everything to a patient.
It seems hospice has moved away from a pastoral care type operation that was nonprofit, model type driven. How much of the industry is now for profit and privately run?
In 2000, only 30% of all hospice providers were for profit. And today it's more than two-thirds. It's around 73%. So it's been a big shift. And the other kind of large investment trend we're seeing in the industry is the incursion of private equity into the space as well.
What does that big shift mean? I mean, what is the difference then between a nonprofit hospice provider and a for-profit one?
In some cases, you're getting the exact same quality of services, and there are, lots of for-profit providers who are committed to a patient-centered mission of care. But studies over the years from both government watchdog reports, independent researchers, and elder care experts have shown that for-profit providers are, on balance, more likely to cut corners on care, have a higher number of substantiated complaints, discharge patients when they become unprofitable or, end up hitting their limit on Medicare reimbursement caps. Perhaps might be more influenced by the amount of money they can bring in per patient than providing the maximal amount of services to each patient on their rolls.
Can you explain who pays for hospice care?
For the most part, I think it's around 95% of hospices are receiving their funding from Medicare. And when you sign up for hospice, you're giving up a right to curative care, and all of your care is now provided under the Medicare Part A benefit, ideally to help you avoid as much pain as possible and remain comfortable. But that'll cover medications and medical supplies. All of that should be through your Medicare plan.
We're talking about a recent investigation into the hospice industry with Ava Kaufman, a reporter for ProPublica. She led this investigation into the hospice industry, which was published by ProPublica and The New Yorker. You can join in on hospice experiences. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Ava, what makes the hospice industry so difficult to regulate?
Part of it is just the nature of the services that are being provided. Hospice takes place behind closed doors, out of sight for the most part, in people's homes. Death itself is a really hard kind of quantity to measure, whether it's being done right or not right. Even in the best of cases, what a good death looks like, I think would be, we'd be hard pressed to define it, most of us. So, even from a structural perspective, it's really hard to measure, but there's also kind of not enough necessarily being done, according to government watchdogs, when it comes to surveying hospices as regularly as they could be surveyed, measuring the quality of care metrics that are available, and that could be measured a little more intensively, and making the data that CMS already, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services already has, more transparent and available to the public, so that people can research and compare and understand that, you know, it's not hospice with a capital H, but there's all sorts of different hospices, and they each might be providing, you know, a different array of services with a different intensity to their patients.
It was interesting that a medical background isn't necessary to enter the hospice industry. I mean, you spoke with accountants and people, you know, not related to the medical field. How are hospice facilities, you know, able to do that and still be regulated and operational if the background of the provider isn't in that type of medical care?
I was really surprised, just as you mentioned, Kate, in the course of my investigation, to come across all kinds of people who are opening and owning and starting up hospices, including criminal defense attorneys and people with felony convictions. Because a lot of hospices don't have actually inpatient facilities and the care is provided at home, you know, you are required, of course, to have registered nurses and licensed vocational nurses and you know, social workers who have appropriate training work at your hospice. But in terms of getting into the business, there is no barrier to entry. And that actually is, you know, the case across many elder care sectors as well.
Is there someone's hospice story you could share with us that was eye-opening for you in this investigation? Is there a story that sticks with you?
Yeah, I mean, the story that kind of caught my eye when I first started out with this reporting, it's the story of a woman named Patricia Marble, who was, by, you know, all accounts, I think, including her own, eligible for hospice when she first went on the service, and had a diagnosis of end-stage COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And she enters hospice with the idea that, you know, she's going to be transitioning to more palliative care. She's going to be foregoing curative treatments, and begins to receive, you know, quite high doses of morphine and medication that, you know, the doctors said were initially kind of intended to soothe her breathing. And as the years go on, she's recertified for hospice over 30 times and ends up on the service for 5 years.
Wow.
Which I think for anyone who knows about hospice, you know, you're supposed to have a life expectancy of 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
And she and her family don't quite realize over the years, you know, what's kind of actually going on, which is that they've, you know, she's being over-medicated, and part of the reason she's kind of getting worse instead of better starts to be that she's on such a high dose of opioids that, you know, people compare it to taking dozens of Percocets a day. And Patricia Marble, and, you know, just to fast forward to the end of the story, is actually still alive and with us today, more than 10 years since she first entered hospice. And I guess what I've been really surprised by following the publication of the investigation is hearing from many other families who saw themselves in this story and said, I didn't know much about what hospice was. And, you know, instead of, you know, of course, prognosis is uncertain, but instead of getting off the service, you know, we kind of got stuck on this because we didn't quite realize that maybe it wasn't appropriate anymore. And we weren't being told by our provider that, you know, there might be other options for us.
Thank you for sharing that story. ProPublica journalist Ava Kaufman with us investigated the inner workings of hospice care in America, problems in the industry. Join in on end-of-life care, what you've wondered about with firms focused on people's final days, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a ProPublica investigation about the big business of hospice that uncovered lax federal oversight and covered fraud and questionable billing? Be part of this conversation about end-of-life care. Your questions about hospice, 800-642-1234. Ava Kaufman is a reporter on ProPublica's National Desk and stays with us. Jane in Suamico has a story. Jane, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. While I understand the importance of the article this reporter has written, I want to speak out in favor of hospice. The many residents in the greater Green Bay area took care of a number of my relatives at the end of life. They could not have been more professional, kinder, more knowledgeable, and couldn't have communicated more clearly with our family about what was happening as our loved ones were dying. They were invaluable to us.
Jane, that's so important to hear that. Ava, did you hear that in your reporting as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, I think, one of the most unique services that we have in our healthcare system in this country. I mean, there's nothing else that's going to provide you with a holistic approach as well, having social workers and bereavement counselors and even volunteers stopping by. And I think one of the things I was most interested to hear as well, Jean and Kate, was even from nurses who'd worked at companies where, you know, they eventually ended up blowing the whistle or accusing their employer of fraud, of inappropriate billing, of signing up ineligible patients. They said, you know, we always wanted to do right, though, by the people that we were taking care of. Hmm. And I think all of the hospice nurses I spoke to in particular, I mean, they see their work as a calling, and they're in this for deep and sometimes even spiritual reasons. And that was one of the kind of most moving and poignant parts of the entire reporting process, was getting to know people who work in the hospice industry.
You mentioned these whistleblower complaints, Marcia Farmer and Don Richardson, two hospice workers who worked in Alabama. Why did they take this step to out their company?
They were long kind of made uneasy by the practices they were seeing around them in terms of the pressure to admit patients who were not necessarily ready for hospice or appropriate for hospice, as well as the pressure to sign up patients in nursing homes, and decided when they saw that, you know, this was even possible, I don't think they realized that blowing the whistle was something they could do, that, you know, what was going on in their company might just not make them uneasy or uncomfortable, but might also be illegal. It might be a form of Medicare fraud. And because they wanted to kind of put an end to that, and I think by the end of their time at the company, were quite, you know, disgusted by the way that this work that they had seen as a calling, to use that word again, had been perverted by a kind of profit-seeking mission above all else, in their view, decided to blow the whistle. And I should add that, you know, they weren't the only whistleblowers at the company, or even the only employees to raise these issues as internal complaints, as the discovery process later showed.
And the Justice Department took over litigation, took the case to court in 2015. What happened in the outcome of this trial?
It was quite an unusual trial, so it's a little hard to say that a trial would ever kind of happen this way again. But the first thing that was unusual was that it ends up going to trial. So a lot of these whistleblower cases, especially against healthcare entities, never end up going to trial. And so that was the kind of first twist. The second is that they were not allowed to bring in the wider evidence they had collected of unusual patterns and practices and what they saw as, you know, fraudulent schemes into the courtroom's first phase. They just were focusing on the medical records themselves and whether or not doctors agreed that they were false or not, whether or not the doctors thought that the supporting documentation was sufficient mm-hmm. to back up the claim. So that really limited what they could say on the stand. And despite that, the jury ends up ruling in their favor, overwhelmingly rules that the claims appear to be, you know, false based on their understanding of the kind of doctor's debate. But the judge ends up kind of deciding that, you know, a debate between doctors is not enough on its own to prove that a claim is true or false. You know, you could go down a slippery slope if you have doctors kind of second guessing each other and accusing companies of, or hospice companies in particular, of Medicare fraud, since all you need to kind of be certified for a hospice is, you know, the judgment of doctors making this prediction about your life expectancy. And so it becomes a really interesting bellwether for, you know, whether this anti-fraud law in the United States will be able to hold hospice companies accountable in the future.
Ava Kaufman with us, reporter, ProPublica's National Desk, looking at the hospice industry. Let's bring in Richard in Two Rivers. Richard, hi. What would you like to add?
Yeah, good morning. I'm not sure if you're aware of what goes on throughout the whole country, but I worked 30 years in physical therapy, and I retired a couple of years ago. And the reason I still could practice, but I didn't want to practice anymore, because there was a decision made whether to put a person on hospice care or put them on a more profitable multi-tier Medicare A. And I was picking up patients that I was forced to see they were obviously had limited days of their life left. And that goes on everywhere. It goes on with a lot of therapists I work with. And it's very hard to deal with. And and as far as I'm concerned, the person that's making the decision is a DON or somebody else. And they always make a decision what's more profitable for the nursing home.
Richard, thank you for that perspective, personal perspective. I want to bring in Peggy in Milwaukee with a story as well. Peggy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I want to share my experience and my mother's experience. My father died about a month ago and was at home hospice. And we were, our eyes were really open to what the service really is. We realized it was a transfer of care for responsibility of your loved one from the medical people to the family. And because all we got from hospice was once a week visit from the nurse and some strong medication that just really put my dad out, and, you know, he wasn't conscious really when he was on that strong medication. And so my mother, who was 93, ended up taking care of my father through this home hospice at home. And really, my father ended up in a hospice care unit for the last 4 hours of his life. It happened to be that the nurse came on the day that he died. And then she said at his bedside, before she called the hospice to see if they had a bed for him, "Well, what is your plan?" Well, we did our plan. I mean, what is your plan? We need help, and we really weren't getting what, you know, much of anything. So they got the profit. And the care is passed off onto the family.
Oh, Peggy, I'm sorry to hear of your loss, and thank you so much for willingly sharing your story. Ava, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much, Richard and Peggy. Richard, to your first point about overbilling kind of happening across the sectors in healthcare, that's absolutely the case. You know, hospice is an outlier in some ways because the population of patients is so vulnerable. You know, I think Peggy, speaking of her family's experience, really highlights that point. And also because, you know, there's almost no political constituency for the patients, since they are, you know, passing away. They often can't advocate for themselves, and their families are in too much grief to do so after the fact. But, you know, the same companies that have been accused of fraud in hospice often have home health wings or physical therapy wings, or are connected to nursing homes that are also accused of overbilling. So I just did want to make that point that these are these practices are often connected and going on or alleged to be going on in parallel. And Peggy, thank you so much for sharing your story. This is unfortunately all too common, and I think is something that's been highlighted in numerous reports by elder care researchers, and is one of the reasons that hospices that are doing their best have been calling to modernize or change how the benefit and reimburses or pays for the service.
We're out of time. Ava Kaufman, reporter for the nonprofit investigative newsroom ProPublica. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about navigating hospice, end-of-life care for pain, and focused on comfort and quality of life. Call in with your questions about hospice care and how it works, 800-642-1234. Angela Novas is here, Chief Medical Officer at the Hospice Foundation of America, certified as a hospice and palliative care advanced practice nurse. Angela, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning, Kate. It's good to be here.
Good. What role, first of all, does your organization have in the hospice industry?
Well, the Hospice Foundation of America is around 40 years old now. We are not direct hospice providers, nor do we oversee or regulate hospice organizations or providers. We were founded around 40 years ago, as independent educational and research focus organization, and we work to improve access to knowledge about hospice and end-of-life care options. We're actually the only not-for-profit in the US that has an Ask an Expert line where you can call to our organization if you're a member of the public and ask questions, or you can email us. And that is a donor-supported service that we provide.
Where is the most education needed in hospice? What do you see?
Misconceptions, I think, about what hospice does and does not provide with regard to services. That can be sort of top of our list of questions. And we do get many members of the public asking if this is all that's provided. So we spend a lot of time and a lot of resources on education.
When you hear that, you know, more than two-thirds of hospice across the country now operate as for-profit businesses, a for-profit model, is that concerning as it's gotten away from the nonprofit orientation of hospice?
I think it would be sweeping and doesn't behoove hospice to try and distinguish between for-profit and not-for-profit. Huh. There are many, many good providers in the for-profit realm, and there are some bad actors also, as we've seen. And they should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, as they have been. But, you know, there's a larger problem, I think, than just whether or not it's for profit or not for profit. As I say, there are good and bad players in both mm-hmm. sectors. But education is the key to people making the right choice for them. And of course, as Ava mentioned, this at the time it was passed, the Medicare hospice benefit in 82, it was revolutionary and it was visionary. But this program, people forget that the program was essentially designed to address the needs of cancer patients. And over the years, it's evolved to cover other very long but devastating prognosis and conditions such as Alzheimer's, where the disease trajectory is in fact very difficult and can be extended over several years. The program wasn't designed for those people with extended prognosis potentially, but it's become encompassed in that. And there probably, you know, does need to be more oversight. And the plan certainly could be changed to reflect its current usage.
Some people think choosing hospice is giving up hope. When should someone consider seeking out hospice care?
Well, the two very distinct things that it depends what you're hoping for. Okay. So reframing what hope is a large part of what hospice providers do. So many people have had a long journey with ill health before making the decision to even consider hospice. So maybe hopes can be redefined as hope. Over 80% of Americans want to die at home. Maybe they're hopeful that they can die at home. Maybe their hope is that they will be able to spend more quality time with their families and loved ones rather than multiple visits to the hospital or other clinics for treatments that are painful or in themselves distressing and taxing.
I'm going to reintroduce you for a moment. Angela Novas with us, Chief Medical Officer for the nonprofit Hospice Foundation of America, as we learn more about hospice care and answering your questions about the process. 800-642-1234. Shelley is with us in Burlington. Shelley, what would you like to raise about hospice?
Hi. I had both parents in hospice approximately 5 years apart. My mother was in hospice in both a nursing home and assisted living, and my father was in hospice at home. And I have to say I agree in that it is not at all the service that is sold in the advertising, and I was not happy with either service as it occurred. One thing to note is that you never get seen by a doctor. You get assigned a doctor. You don't have your choice of doctor, and you never actually get seen by the doctor. You only ever get seen by a nurse who then reports to a doctor and discusses and comes once a week and does her checklist. But that's really about all you get. So my question is, one of the reasons my father ended up in hospice is because he was non-ambulatory and wanted to come home. And frankly, the hospital was kind of kicking him out. And are there any options for getting medical care at home other than hospice?
Shelley, thank you so much for those stories, that personal account. Angela, go ahead.
Some of this largely depends on additional insurances and whether or not there's any coverage. Some people have supplemental insurances in addition to Medicare that will pick up some of the cost of caregiving needs. Other people pay out of pocket. Other people seek volunteer services through local church groups and other not-for-profit organizations. And some people, of course, now, although it's still not that common, but long-term care insurance is becoming increasingly popular.
Does a hospice patient then relinquish their ability to like see their primary care physician or go to a hospital after they've committed to hospice care? How does that work?
You can keep your own physician and have your own physician as an attending in most cases, if they so wish. But depending on what your primary hospice diagnosis is, if you were to see your primary care physician for matters regarding that primary hospice diagnosis, that likely wouldn't be paid for because you would be expected to consult with your hospice team on matters related to that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you were on hospice because you had end-stage dementia and went to a neurologist for a consult to get your medications changed for that end-stage dementia, there may be some chance that you would be expected to pay for that visit because that's what you have asked hospice to take care of. But if you were to have end-stage dementia and needed to go and see a podiatrist because of an ingrown toenail with an infection, certainly you may go and see that specialist and get that taken care of if it's distressing to you and causing you pain or discomfort.
So, you know, I mean, we keep hearing about having just very limited visits by a nurse, maybe once a week. What is mm-hmm. and isn't included in hospice care? And how much, you know, oversight is there from a hospice nurse?
Yeah, that's one of the more common misconceptions that we deal with, because people feel that once they sign on for hospice, hospice takes over that caregiving role completely. And it was never designed to be that way. Hospice care was designed to supplement family, private caregivers, or friends caregiving in the home. It was never meant to be to take over that caregiving responsibility. It was meant to supplement it. So the nursing visits typically are once a week, so long as that patient is stable and their symptoms are well controlled. If those symptoms are not controlled well, or there is something else going on, the nurse will visit however many times a week is necessary. So it can vary. They can, if somebody's very comfortable and very well medicated and is not having any challenges and is just enjoying the time they have left with their family and friends at home, the nurse may even visit once every 2 weeks. There may be a nursing aide that will go in. The average nationally is about 3 times a week. They will go in for an hour 3 times a week and help with activities of daily living, bathing, turning. And of course, volunteers will be able to go into the home. Volunteer services vary a little bit by region and of course vary by whoever's willing to provide those services, but can include things like Reiki therapy, music therapy, or even just sitting and providing companionship while the family caregivers have some downtime to do something for themselves or take care of family business. But the plan was never designed to take over that primary caregiving role within the household.
Angela Novas with us, Chief Medical Officer at the Hospice Foundation of America. Its mission to educate people and health professionals on death, dying, and grief. Join in the conversation on hospice, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent as we explore when hospice care is appropriate, when to know it's time, how to access end-of-life care. We have the nonprofit Hospice Foundation of America. Bring your questions and experiences about end-of-life care, 800-642-1234. Angela Novas is the foundation's chief medical officer and stays with us. Angela, what are your tips and suggestions for how to, you know, potential hospice patients and their families find local providers?
They can reach out to us. If you Google Hospice Foundation of America, you'll find our email ports and telephone number. We can help you locate local providers. There's also a service called Care Compare. And if you Google Care Compare, and whatever service that you're looking for, whether it be hospice, palliative care, or nursing homes, that will allow you to search by area code, by your zip code, to find local providers in your area. And it will also give you a ranking of how those providers have been rated by previous consumers.
How would you go about interviewing providers or choosing which one to go with?
You know, that's a good question, too. For the most part, we really do encourage people to speak with friends and neighbors, speak with their private physician or nurse practitioner groups, and get recommendations from them. Because, of course, if you are reaching out blindly to a company or an organization or hospice group, they will, of course, they want you to go with them, and they will, tell you about their services and everything that they can offer to you. But it really is helpful if you can speak to somebody who's used their services previously. And many local physicians and nursing home organizations will be very frank with you and tell you, we like to work with this hospice organization. They are easy to work with from our perspective. And that's always a good thing. You want to have providers who are take good care of your family member, of course, but are also easy to work with and open about their services and working with your current providers and have good communications with you as your family.
How has the pandemic affected the hospice care industry, and has the pandemic changed it in any way?
As somebody who is a hospice or has been a hospice and palliative care provider for profits and not for profits, and has worked in inpatient units and in patients' home, the pandemic was devastating. And you would think that as caregivers who work with end-of-life people as a calling or a career decision, that we would be used to death and dying. But the impact, the sheer numbers and volumes were devastating and traumatic. For the families, for us to witness loss on that kind of scale was devastating. Staff shortages as a result of many people in healthcare deciding that they needed some time away from healthcare because of that trauma, or people who just decided this was time to retire. The people who were left behind were struggling with the overwhelming need, as well as their own challenges during that time, and fears for their own safety.
It all came to a head.
It really did, and I do think it caused many to reflect on whether or not they wanted to continue in healthcare. And it certainly was a turning point, and it did change the face. And of course, the overwhelming need for grief. HFA also provides education about grief. A lot of what we do is with Ken Doker works very closely with us. And, just the overwhelming need for grief counseling at a time where everybody was struggling, including hospices, to provide those basic needs, even for patients and family members who they had been working with. And many of the volunteer programs were closed down, and just that human connection was lost. It's a very different scenario trying to provide grief counseling or even patient education or assessment over a Zoom meeting or a telephone, because of the restrictions that were in place. It kind of felt like that human connection that people, I think, who work in hospice and end-of-life care strive for, is that one-on-one human connection and humanity that was very difficult to convey.
Grief being one of the focuses of Hospice Foundation of America, how can caregivers address their grief while a loved one's condition is deteriorating rapidly?
It can be overwhelming. And of course, many people who come to hospice It isn't until they come to hospice. You were talking about hope earlier. Many people who come to us have been very aggressively seeking treatment and running around on errands and appointments, and their life has been filled with cure. And then to come to hospice and the pace will change. It goes from being a focus on cure to a focus on comfort and a focus on supporting the family in this end of life journey. And simply the fact that sometimes I think having more time and shifting that focus can impact people's emotions and the grief that they're feeling. And the grief can be anticipatory with people who are at end of life through, say, dementia. Many people convey to us, and I've personally experienced this, that you lose your loved one before they die because the cognitive deficits at some point take them away from you. So you have the person is still with you, but your loved one is gone some respects. And that anticipatory grief can be very challenging.
We only have I'm sorry, I keep interrupting.
Well, it can
you.
Be yeah. conflicting. No, it's fine. But it can be conflicting because, sometimes the death of your loved one can actually be a relief, and that's okay. It doesn't mean you're not grieving. It means you are just happy that they are no longer suffering. And that's okay.
Because you can feel such guilt in those circumstances. Such a complicated issue. Angela, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
No problem. It was a pleasure to be here.
Angela Novas is Chief Medical Officer at the Hospice Foundation of America. We have a link on our program page at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.